can't be tied back to you through your driver's license number. And then therefore it will fail the ability to use it as an authentication mechanism in many cases. Well, if you have you know, big concerns about those things and you want some more personalized advice, you know how to reach me.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Oh, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features author Joe Feldman, who has a new book from Corwin Press titled Grading for Equity: What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. Joe has worked in education at the local and national levels for over 20 years in both charter and district school contexts as a teacher, principal, and district administrator. He's worked in Atlanta Public Schools, at a charter high school in Washington, D.C., has been director of charter schools for New York City Department of Education, and director of K-12 instruction in Union City, California, worked for U.S. Secretary of Education Richard Riley. And Joe Feldman is currently CEO of Crescendo Education Group, a consulting organization that partners with schools and districts to help teachers use improved and more equitable grading and assessment practices. Joe graduated from Stanford University, Harvard Graduate School of Education, and New York University Law School. And he lives in Oakland, California. He's joining us here from Oakland by phone today to talk about his book, Grading for Equity. So welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Karen. Good to talk with you.
Good. So let's just start with the main question. What is wrong with the way that we approach grading in our schools currently? What exactly is the problem you're trying to solve?
Well, grades are used to make all kinds of really significant decisions about students, including promotion, retention, college admission, scholarships, what academic track they're on, whether they get to participate in sports. And parents and teachers and school administrators are committed to providing opportunities for every student to be successful. But what's happening is that many common grading practices are often outdated and inaccurate and actually undermine student success. Grading policies, which appear to be objective, fair, and accurate ways to describe students' academic performance, often actually increase achievement gaps.
So then why, if there's so many things wrong with this, why are we, and by we I include myself and my colleagues at the college level, why are we so wedded to grading in the way that we've been doing it?
Well, grading isn't addressed in any teacher preparation programs in the K-12 level, and I would be surprised if there was any discussion of how to grade at the post-secondary level. And so we really just replicate how we were taught as students. And we try and do our best. And unfortunately, we just aren't given access to the history of grading and in what ways we could make grading more accurate and more fair.
So tell me about the system of grading. How does this system develop? And, you know, have students always been graded the way that they are now with sort of A, B, C, D, and you know, 93 to 100 is an A and so forth? Or you know, when did that all start?
Well, we used to have in the 1800s, we had the one-room schoolhouses where there wasn't any letter grading and there wasn't any percentage scales. It was, you know, teachers used whatever curriculum they had on hand, and they'd teach students for multiple years. And they would the way they would give feedback and report student progress would be by having conversations with their parents or families or by writing kind of narrative descriptions. It wasn't until the Industrial Revolution happened that we had to change all of that. We now had this great influx of families into the cities, which is where the jobs were, And we had to figure out how we were going to educate all of those workers' students or children. And when we had all of them in these big buildings, we had to figure out how to be the most efficient we could be. Efficiency was very important in the Industrial Revolution. And we also wanted to be very precise. So that's when we started using the 0 to 100 scale because it gave us a lot of precision. And we started using the A through F scale because it allowed us to easily label and then sort our students into who was going to be the workers and who was going to be the bosses. And continuing to use those aspects means that we're still trying to use it for purposes that don't match what we think schools should be nowadays.
I think I've quoted before, I can't remember who it was, refers to this as batch processing by date of manufacture. That's age grading of students.
I love that.
So, you know, and I guess that's really part of this whole system, too, because when we say where, you know, what if you look even at standardized tests, we say whether or not students are at grade level, which is basically batch processing by date of manufacture. Grade level is just, are you the same level as all the other kids that are your age? And we don't really do that to anyone else at other stages in life. So it's sort of a strange practice, but it's so embedded in almost everything that we do.
That's right. And that's part of the irony. And I'm not suggesting that we just throw out everything we know, but it's really thinking more critically about the A through F scale, for example, and thinking, is there a better way than a better scale of describing student performance than a 0 to 100 scale?
Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to have you describe your proposed replacement for the system, and it's based on three pillars. So let's first start just kind of give an overview, and then we'll look at each of those pillars separately. So can you describe what you mean how you would base a new system?
Right. So, and it's not just what I would do. It's really what research has shown is more effective and equitable. So the three pillars are, one, that grading would be accurate, which means that we would use calculations that are mathematically sound and easy to understand and correctly describe a student's level of academic performance. The second is that it would be motivational. So it would motivate students to be academically successful through support of a growth mindset and give students opportunities at redemption. And the third is that equitable grading would be bias resistant. So it would give all students an opportunity to succeed by counteracting institutional biases and limiting the impact of teachers' subjective implicit biases.
Okay, so let's start with pillar number one, accuracy. You know, so what's so wrong with a 0 to 100 scale? I mean, what would you do instead of that?
Well, so specifically, the 0 to 100 scale is disproportionately oriented toward failure, even on its face. So let's say a 60% is passing. So that means that we almost have two-thirds of our scale designed to identify all those levels of failure and only a third of the scale to identify levels of success, which seems really contrary to the kind of messages that we want to be sending. Mathematically, if you get a zero because you didn't hand in an assignment, for example, mathematically it becomes very difficult to dig yourself out of that. And no research supports the idea that if you give a student a very, very low grade, it will motivate them to do better. It usually motivates them in the opposite direction or demotivates them. So instead of a 0 to 100, I'm suggesting that we would use a 0 to 4 scale, which is actually what we use for GPA. It's very similar to the AP exam scores. What it does is it has fewer gradations. So it just much more easily allows you to describe levels of performance that's much more proportional. So now 20% is about failure, or maybe 40% if you're going up to the D or the 3. And the rest of it is about success, which is a better message and doesn't burrow students in failure if they get a few early failures.
Mm-hmm. So let's just try to make an example of that. Let's say you are a math teacher and you give a traditional exam and the student gets 75% of the questions right. Mm-hmm. So how does that translate to your suggested scale?
Well, I would actually take a step back. So it probably matters to the teacher which 75% the student got right. So if we had a test and they got 75% of the easy questions right and none of the hard questions right, that would be different than if they got 75% of the hard questions right and none of the easy ones right. So I think part of it is really thinking about what are we trying to how do we want to describe student success? And maybe it's not by an accumulation of points. It's not the number of points that a student accumulated, but it's rather what level of mastery has the student demonstrated. And I think if we start thinking about it in that way, we can then say, okay, so an A is where they show above competence, above proficiency. A B is where they've met the standards for the course. A C is where they've got some gaps in their understanding. And a D might be that they can't show proficiency or they've got some gaps and can't really even get there unless they have help. So I think reorganizing how we think about describing and reporting student success can go a long ways into making a more equitable system.
Okay, so let's say that the teacher has thought that through and, you know, there's a section at the beginning that with easier questions and that's weighted differently than the harder questions. But they've thought it through and the student got three quarters of the questions correct or the points or whatever they decided to award. So then in your system, do they get like a three or how does that work?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is just use the GPA system to respond sort of at the most, the clearest level. It's the GPA. So an A is a 4, a B is a 3, a C is a 2, a D is a 1. So in that example, you might say that, well, that student actually, by getting 75%, it actually showed that they're at a C level.
Oh, okay.
They didn't quite get proficient because they've got some significant gaps.
Okay. And then how would changing that label instead of saying a 75, and you know, a 75, a teacher might label that as a C. So, so do you just say do away with the 75 and just use the C or, you know, I'm not really sure I understand how this is different.
Right. So you actually no longer use points. So there is no 0 to 100 scale. I mean, to get really nitty gritty. Because really, if I asked a teacher, what's the difference between a student who has a 75 and a student who has a 74 in terms of their level of content knowledge? You couldn't tell me the difference. You could only say one got 1% higher than the other. So instead, let's describe students with fewer gradations. So, and if you want, you can use pluses and minuses. But instead, we could say, okay, the student, based on this total number of their total body of work and responding to the questions of my test, showed me that they are at a C level or a C plus level. And by describing it like that, now we're actually empowering students to use a different kind of vocabulary to describe their learning. Instead of saying, oh, I'm at, you know, a 72, I need to get two more and I'll get a 74, or I'm 1 point away from an A. Instead, say, oh, if I understand how to use the FOIL method, but I don't yet know how to do it with negative exponents. So if I can learn how to do it with negative exponents, I'll be able to get a B. And that really changes the dialogue that happens in a classroom and the way students think about their own learning.
Okay. We might come back to that, but I want to move on to pillar two, which is bias resistant. So I'm playing the skeptic here because I know how teachers are going to probably, or parents, or might approach this. So I'm going to say, so why should we even care about that? Aren't teachers supposed to be neutral and unbiased?
Of course. And the problem is that they take some steps to be unbiased. And like, for example, having students write their name on the back of tests instead of the front, so teachers aren't judging those tests differently based on their knowledge of the student or opinion of the student. But there are other ways that it creeps into their grading that they're not aware of. And the problem is then it starts to warp the accuracy and fairness. So an example is teachers often include a participation category of grading, at least at the K-12 level. And that includes things like, you know, are the students paying attention? Or are they being prepared? Or are they acting respectfully? And the first problem with that is that it's all those things and the way that teachers judge those are really a projection of what good participation looks for them, the teacher. What made me successful? It's having a notebook that's organized in a particular kind of way. Or what I think paying attention looks like is what how I look when I pay attention. And the problem is that those behaviors may have nothing to do with the student's amount of learning. That students may actually learn more by doodling than by looking the teacher in the eye when they're talking, for example. Or I may have a messy notebook, or messy as described by the teacher, but it actually doesn't have anything to do with how much I'm learning. The second problem with it is that teachers are looking at those behaviors through a biased lens and may not actually be judging them objectively. So we know from research that teachers will interpret students' behaviors in different ways depending on the student's race and gender. And so what we want is not to include aspects of student behavior in the grade, because once we do that, it starts to warp the accuracy and make the grade more about the subjective biases of the teacher rather than about an objective description of the student's performance.
So, and I might be stretching this a little, but I'm just wondering how you feel about some of the schools that advocate students, you know, marching in a straight line, sitting at their desk with their hands folded, tracking the teacher for whatever the teacher is doing, responding, you know, sort of in a chant, those kinds of things. Yeah. How does that fit in here?
Well, I'll have my response be very narrow and then I can make it larger. But very narrowly, as long as the student's performance on that isn't included in the grade, then we can have more confidence that the grade is only about what the student knows, not how they behave. Mm. A broader response is, I think we run the possibility that we are managing behaviors of students in a way that is not so different than some of the schools where we would take in Native Americans and we would teach them to act white. I mean, we are trying to really mandate certain kind of behaviors and control behaviors in a way that is artificial and I think is can get dehumanizing.
Right. So the old, you're talking about the old Native American boarding schools where children were taken from their parents when they were about 5 years old and brought there and given new names, not forbidden from speaking their native languages, that sort of thing. So,
yeah. And that's an extreme case, but I think it runs along that continuum.
Okay. Let me just reintroduce. You're listening to WGTD HD FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of grading for equity with the author Joe Feldman is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So you've named and talked a little bit about the first two pillars, the pillar of accuracy and why we should think about changing our grading practices so that they are more accurate and they reflect better what our students have learned. You've also talked about your second pillar, which is bias resistant, trying to make sure that we are using only subjective criteria to grade
only
students.
Objective.
I'm sorry, objective. Thank you. That's what I meant to say. And then the third pillar is motivation. So how does your system motivate students more than just getting an A or a 95%?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to one of the biggest currencies that are in the classroom, which is points. You know, students enter school as kindergartners and, you know, in first grade, and the question that never gets asked is how many points is this worth when they're asked to do something? They're just curious and interested in learning. And somewhere about the fourth grade, fifth grade, teachers start introducing the idea of points. So you'll get 5 points for being on time, or the group that's quiet first will get 5 points, or you'll lose 5 points if something's handed in late. And that really blossoms in middle school and in high school. And that really is an artifact of the Industrial Revolution. So during that time, behaviorism came into vogue. The idea that you could best motivate people through extrinsic motivation and punishments. This is Skinner and his mice in the boxes, where he taught them to press the lever if he gave them food and shock them until they pressed the lever. So we have then integrated into our grading system an idea that the way to get students to behave in certain ways is to award them points or subtract points. And that then gets in our grading system in a way where students become consumed with the points. And it kind of goes back a little bit to what we were talking about earlier, where students won't really think about how much have I learned or what have I not yet learned. All they're concerned about is how many points do I have? And they will beg for points, haggle for points, get points by any way possible. And so we can actually create more intrinsic motivated students by changing the way that we grade. So let me give you an example. So homework. Why do students do homework? Students do homework because the teacher told them to and they get points for it. But teachers assign homework because they want students to practice material and learn material and make mistakes in that material and be able to do better when they get to the tests. So we've got students who are only concerned about doing homework so it gets completed. And so there's lots of ways that then students do anything possible to get homework completed. They will copy, they will ask their parents for help, the tutor might do it, they will go online and copy things. And that has nothing to do with whether or not they've actually learned. And so if instead we said that you're expected to do homework, but it is not going to be, your performance on the homework is not included in the grade, we now are saying homework is for you. You do as much of it or as little as you think appropriate for your learning. And you'll either get that answer right or wrong. You'll either do the homework and you'll learn and you'll do better on the test, or you won't, and then you won't do well. And then we'll have a way for students to think about, well, how do I then take a retake on this test? Or how do I do this homework now so that I can be eligible for a retake? All of which helps students reconnect the idea of what homework is for to its purpose.
Now, doesn't that have the potential of putting a lot of pressure on those testing experiences for a student then?
It does, until you open up the idea of retakes, which is another aspect of this work. So traditionally, we have tests and you take it once and you did well or you didn't and you move on. And this would be that, well, you could actually learn from your mistakes on the test and you could redo tests or take different kinds of assessments.
So working toward mastery of the material rather than just getting through something.
That's right.
So you could go back and repeat and go back and then increase your score, but really the score would more accurately reflect that you had learned.
Right. And this goes back a little bit to another aspect of the accuracy, which is that normally if students did a bunch of work over time, they on their first test, they did terrible on some concept. On the next test, they did a little better. In the final exam, they did great. We average performance over time. Mm-hmm. And averaging, you can ask any mathematician, averaging is not, you would never say you should always average performance over time and that'll give you the most accurate score. Mm-hmm. In fact, in that example, you're actually punishing the student who did poorly at the beginning, even though they did everything you asked. They learned all the material and were successful at the end. So another aspect of this is only looking at a student's most recent performance. How did they do at the end of their learning, not averaging their performance over time?
Yeah, that actually does make a lot of sense. So I'm just trying to think of this from the perspective of a teacher, or more accurately, since I prepare teachers, you know, if I go to my class tomorrow and talk to them about this, what could I tell them? How could they set up their classroom? So let's say we have a 10th grade English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So they assign a lot of different kinds of work. You know, they obviously reading, writing, speaking, and listening. Those are the language arts. So how would they develop, let's say, a unit on expository writing that might end in some kind of a grade?
Well, I think there are lots of places to start. Mm-hmm. And one way is to have them, and I'm sure you do this as we think about Wiggins and McTee, how do you design from the end in mind?
Right.
So
backwards,
what are the
planning.
Backwards, that's right, backwards. So what are the standards that you're teaching? And secondly, what would a student performance look like that would categorize them in the different levels of performance on that standard? So if students are supposed to be able to write a persuasive essay or whatever, I can't remember what your content was.
Right. But, it could be a persuasive essay, yeah.
Sure. What is the rubric that describes a high quality persuasive essay and the different levels of that mastery. And then you would just identify each of those as a letter or as a number on a 0 to 4 scale. Mm. And then as you teach, you'll be able to actually know, and hopefully the students would too, where they fall on that continuum of the 0 to 4 or F to A level of mastery of being able to write a persuasive essay. And then all the work that you do is designed to prepare students so that they can, you know, achieve as much as possible.
So they might, let's say in the course of the unit, they write 3 essays, and the first one, their mastery level is 2 or 2.1 or something like that, you know, so they got a 2 on most of the items on the rubric, but not all of, they got 1 better. And right. Then the second time they do it, they might have a 3. And then the third time, they might have a 4 in an ideal world. Right. And so that's really what you're working toward, is just kind of moving up that scale of mastery.
That's right. And then the grade that they would get would be a 4. The mm-hmm. the 2.1 and the 3 would never get calculated as part of their grade. Mm-hmm. And it's really an issue of equity also, because you can imagine that there might be some students in your class whose parents put them in a summer writing program at the local college where they learned how to write a persuasive essay, or their parents are there that can help them. And so they might be getting an A from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and they keep getting A's. And then you've got other students who didn't have those opportunities and came in and wrote a horrible essay the first time, but they learned everything and wrote the same level as the first student by the end. You did your job and they did theirs. So you wouldn't want to penalize that student by averaging their performance.
Huh. Right. Yeah, and I think, I mean, so we do teach our students to use rubrics and to teach to that, but I think we're still wedded to this sort of, then once you do the rubric, you add up the points and that's your grade, rather than just saying, okay, you've mastered or you haven't mastered.
Right, and it just shows how pervasive the mm-hmm. the 100-year-old system is.
Right, because it doesn't, I can't really defend that to you right now. It's just the way it's been done.
Yep.
So, okay. Well, I guess I'm proving your point. So if there are teachers, or actually let's turn to parents. So there are parents in the audience right now listening. We've sort of already just said this, but I want you to kind of address them directly. Tell them how adopting this system might help their student in the short and in the long run.
Well, first, it would stop them from doing everything they can to get homework done and being feeling so much stress. Now, what we find is that when teachers adopt these practices, the classroom environment totally changes, where students aren't so consumed with getting everything right all the time on every assignment and every aspect of the classroom work, that they can really start to prioritize differently and do much more authentic learning. The second thing is that they can have greater faith that the grades they would get from the teachers would accurately describe them. There are a number of cases where, you know, students will get straight A's, and really they might have been at the B level in terms of content knowledge, but they were just a wonderful person and followed all the directions. Mm-hmm. And they go to college and get crushed because they had been led to believe that they were ready or could take advanced classes, and they get in there and the content is just extremely difficult for them and they don't know why. So teachers, parents can have much more trust and faith that the grades they get from teachers accurately describe what the students know.
Huh. I definitely can see how, especially for schools that have a lot of homework, which is another whole question that we could ask about. But I have some colleagues whose children spend 3-4 hours a night on homework. And I guess if you change this and the homework itself wasn't getting the grade, but it was the mastery that students showed in some other way, they might be able to pick and choose how much of that homework they do, I suppose.
That's right. And that's what students say when we start to use these practices in schools. Students will tell us that they feel much more in control and much more empowered to make decisions about what they most need in order to learn. Mm-hmm. And it also actually raises the stakes a little bit for teachers, that teachers, I think, sometimes feel like, well, there's just this expectation I give homework. So I'm just going to give some homework because the parents think that if I give more homework, then the students are learning more. And it forces them to then be actually much more deliberate about when they assign homework and what the homework is, because they know that students can make the decision for themselves about whether it's valuable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say one of our listeners is a teacher and she or he is sort of sold on this idea. Besides buying your book and reading it, what are some specific things that a teacher might be able to do right now that might move them toward this and help maybe by example convince fellow teachers and parents and students that this is a good idea?
Yeah, well, this can be a tough sell to teachers because grading is something that is so personal to them. And with all the expectations placed on teachers and all the mandates and restrictions, grading can feel like the last island of autonomy that they have. And so teachers approach this with a lot of skepticism and wariness. But when they see how the system that they've been using is so outdated and undermines what they're trying to do in their classrooms, they start to try these things. Some easy things are, or some kind of first level things are, to stop awarding extra credit. There's no need to make up new kinds of assignments and new activities and opportunities that oftentimes only the most resourced students and their families can take advantage of, when all the curriculum and all the expectations are already built in. You've already built it. Another thing is to think about retakes and how that might work so that students have multiple opportunities for success. And secondly, I would say that it's really important for teachers to collect some information and evidence about what happens when they do these things. So give a survey to students and ask them how often they've copied homework or what having a retake was like for them. And those voices and that information can be very persuasive to colleagues, much more than sort of a theoretical discussion about the pros and cons.
Mm-hmm. So we're not just doing this, though, to make the students happier, although I think that is a reasonable goal because there are some students who are very stressed out and it would be better to have mentally healthy students. But, you know, does it really contribute to their learning? So I'm not a huge fan of standardized tests, but they are a reality. So I'm wondering how schools who've moved to this system, how it translates into those external measures mm-hmm. that they have to meet.
Well, so first of all, schools are finding that when they use these practices, their D and F rate goes down, because when students get more opportunities to be successful and they use a mathematical numerical system for describing success that isn't so weighted toward failure, it's a lot easier for kids to dig themselves out. Mm-hmm. And so they're finding a decrease in D's and F's, particularly for lower income kids and kids of color. There's also a slight decrease in A's that are awarded. And the highest percentage of students who are getting a decrease in A's a disproportionate percentage of the students who are getting a decrease in A's are kids who are white and of higher income, mm-hmm. interestingly. So it shows a little bit about who the previous system was benefiting and hurting when you start to change that system. What we're also finding is on the standardized tests, and I have reservations about tests just like you do, but I would want the grades to be more closely correlated than farther away from the test scores. And what we're finding is that the grades are more closely correlating with the standardized test scores as they start to use these systems. So in other words, the grades are more accurate. Mm-hmm. In addition to being more equitable and more motivational.
Right. I think it's always it's a bit of a mystery. So when a student's standardized test scores, their individual scores versus their grades, there's a huge mismatch. Now, I think what might discourage people are the students who have figured out how to get the high grades because they work really hard or they do all the extra credit or they do every single piece of homework, but still don't do well in standardized tests.
Right.
How are they going to recover from that? Is this somehow going to help them do better on the standardized tests? Or?
Well, I mean, I think there's lots of reasons why students don't do well in standardized tests, you know, whether it be anxiety or they're just they're it's harder for them to function under a timed method or all kinds of things. I think what we should make sure that though that happens in schools is that the way that we're assessing students gives us the most accurate information. So, you know, I think a lot of us in education think, well, you know, I want to differentiate and have lots of opportunities for students to describe what they know because I want students to have every chance to show me what they know. Mm-hmm. That's why I would not just give, you know, a written multiple choice test, but I might do an essay or I might have kids do a project. But I would actually adjust that question. And I think that our goal as teachers, when we give an assessment or a test, is to make sure that we access as clearly as possible what's in that kid's head. Mm-hmm. And if I give a test and I heard yesterday that kid gave, you know, a great answer to a question, and I asked a very similar question on my test and the kid bombed it, I now know that my test got in the way of me accessing how much that kid knows. And I can then say, okay, I don't really care if the kid got that question right or not or how many points that was worth. I know yesterday the student answered that correctly. So I'm going to consider that as I describe what the student knows and give a grade. So it really frees up the teacher in many ways to use their judgment even more than they were able to.
Okay. Let me just do a quick reintroduction. You are listening to WGTD HD-FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the science, of grading for equity with author Joe Feldman is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So the science thing that I misread just now is based on the fact that last month my guest was a cognitive psychologist. So we were talking about the science of learning. And he had a lot of advice on how people learn and retain information. He was working, I think, within a traditional college grading system. And one of the pieces of advice he had for retention of information was studying towards something. That testing and quizzes actually help students retain information. So does your system allow for traditional tests and quizzes, or is there some other way you would recommend to do that?
No, I mean, I'm really agnostic about the means by which a teacher assesses students. And I do think that I agree with the psychologist in the idea that you're all gearing everything and orienting everything in your classroom toward the assessment. Not to add pressure to students, but to give them a focus about what's the reason for all this work that we're doing. So the classwork that we do, the homework that we do, the practices, maybe even some quizzes, they wouldn't actually count so much in the grade, if at all. But it's how they do on these major assessments. Mm-hmm. And if students don't do well on them, they would have the opportunity to retake part of them or take a different kind of assessment in order for them to show what they know.
Okay, so it's really just about showing what they know. And how they get to the point where they can show that, that's really right. The question. It's that there should probably be a variety of ways to show that.
It could be. And again, because the goal of the teacher is to access as accurately as and to describe as accurately as possible what's in that kid's head. Mm-hmm. So whatever means they need to access that, whether whatever kind of assessments, they should use that. But all in service of having the grade accurately describe what the student knows and not include extraneous information like did they turn in something on time or were they prepared for class or did they raise their hand.
Okay. One of your chapters talks specifically about soft skills or, you know, sort of the communication skills and other kinds of real world preparation. And those are ideas that have a lot of purchase within the business world. And as we know, a lot of business people help make decisions about education through their roles in the community. So let's pretend that sitting here in the studio with me, there isn't anyone here, but let's just say that one of our listeners is the local president of the Chamber of Commerce. So why will this system make for better future employees?
Well, I think the traditional grading system makes for factory employees, people who follow directions and they get their paycheck based on following directions. Because when we award points for everything a student does, that's essentially what we're training them to do. What grading more equitably does is it tells students all of these soft skills are hugely important. And the reason why they're important is because they help you be successful. And whatever way you need to figure out how you can be most successful, that's what you need to figure out. So for example, in group work, a lot of teachers will say, well, I'm going to grade a student, I'm going to give them points based on how well they work in groups, because that's a really important soft skill. I agree that it's a critically important soft skill, but what makes a group productive, what makes high quality group work, is them producing high quality learning for each of the members. If they look like they're doing a good job, but nobody's learning, there's no reason for me to give them points. So I would tell the business person that what we're doing is we're helping students internalize the value of soft skills and seeing them as means to an end, not end in itself.
Okay. So really what you're trying to do is instill a system of intrinsic motivation within the students.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So it's getting them to take ownership of their own learning and to care about it.
Right. And our current system really does very little of that.
Right.
Everything is just to please the teacher.
Right. I would agree with that. So our listeners really appreciate sort of real world stories about actual successes. So can you describe for us, we have about 2 minutes left. So can you describe for us a real success that you've seen, something that was changed for the better by application of these ideas?
Sure. So there's a high school teacher in Los Angeles who works in a school with a predominantly Latino population, and she teaches, I think, English. And she asked students to do a test, and she allowed for retakes. And so the student took it one time and got a D and said, well, can I retake it? And the teacher says, sure, first you need to, you know, do the homework you didn't do and prepare with me, and then I'll let you retake it. And the student retook it and got a C. And then the student said, can I retake it again? And she says, yep, there's unlimited retakes. You can continue learning. So again, more work. And the student then got, I think, a C+, and wanted to take it again and got a B. And before the teacher told them that it got a B, it was like the fourth time the teacher took the test. And the student was kind of following the teacher around, like, can you tell me what I got? I think I did better. And the teacher gave the student a B. And the student said, oh, could I take it home? And the teacher said, well, I guess, why is this so important? You've seen this test four times now. And the student said, because I've never gotten a B on a test. Hmm. And the teacher realized that that this student could be successful. It just took them longer. It just took more time and multiple attempts. And the teacher said, you know, it made me really think about how many students have I hurt or have gotten low grades that they shouldn't have gotten because I didn't know about these ideas. And that's not a unique response to her. There's lots of teachers who say, I wish I would have known this earlier. But they had no choice. It was what we were taught as teachers. We just imitated it, what we experienced as students. So now's our opportunity.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate this. You've given us a lot to think about. Our guest has been author Joe Feldman, who wrote the book Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. I will put a link to that book up on our Facebook page. You have been listening to WGTD HD-FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of Grading for Equity with author Joe Feldman is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find the Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Joe.
Thank you. This was great.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Enjoy the wonders of the season with beautiful fall decor, cozy sweaters and coats, and scrumptious Halloween candy, plus pumpkin lattes, shakes, and even waffles being served daily at Jack's Cafe, jackandrea.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Brighton Woods Orchard, offering 150 varieties of apples as well as grapes and pears over the course of the growing season. Also this Saturday, musician Carrie Spitzer. Winter Harbor Market is open at the Rodeo.